As I mentioned, tonight's topic, the title of this Dharma talk is More Suffering or More Happiness. And there's a very famous thing that the Buddha said that sort of begins everything in a way. And he said, "I teach only suffering and the end of suffering." So he's teaching, this is why you suffer, this is why things are unpleasant, this is why things are don't work, and here's a way to end that. That sums up all the Buddha's teachings in one really simple sentence. But of course, he spent a lot of time talking with this in a variety of different ways. The sutta I'm going to start with and this is called the Mahadhamma Samadhamma Sutta, the Greater Discourse on Ways of Undertaking Things. It's MN 46. And basically in this sutta he it's basically using a very sort of classical teaching method. He's taking two things, suffering, not suffering. So it's a pair, right? And there's four ways you can combine those two together, right? And whether something is pleasant or something is painful is how it's expressed in the sutta. And so I just want to read a little bit of the language here. This is the bhikkhus talking. "Venerable sir, our teachers are rooted in the Blessed One, guided by the Blessed One. Have the Blessed One as their resort. It would be good if the Blessed One would explain the meaning of these words." The words, of course, are, "If only unwished for, undesired, disagreeable things would diminish, wished for, desired, agreeable things would increase. Yet although beings wish, have this wish, desire, and longing, unwished for, undesired, disagreeable things increase for them, and wished for, desired, agreeable things diminish." That is, you get the opposite of what you wish for. Listen. "Here, because an untaught ordinary disciple, that's us, who has no regard for the noble ones and is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma, has no regard for true men and is unskilled and undisciplined in the Dhamma, does not know what things should be cultivated and what things should not be cultivated." It's this word cultivated that the Buddha, you see this a lot in the Buddhist teachings. It's like, here's where you should put your energy. Here's where you shouldn't put your energy, right? We cultivate things, it takes energy. "He doesn't know what things should be followed and what things should not be followed. Not knowing this, he cultivates things that should not be cultivated and does not cultivate things that should be cultivated. He follows things that should not be followed and does not follow things that should not be followed." And that's why things are, yeah. And then he basically lays these four possibilities. "Now, because one who is ignorant, not knowing this way of undertaking things, that is painful now and ripens in the future as pain, does not understand as it actually is thus. This way of undertaking things is painful now and ripens in the future as pain." And then he's going through these four things, right? Because there are four ways of undertaking things. What are the four? There's the way of undertaking things that is painful now and ripens in the future as pain. There's a way of undertaking things that is pleasant now and ripens in the future as pain. There are things, ways of undertaking things that is painful now but ripens into the future as pleasure. They're ways of undertaking things now that are pleasant now and ripen in the future as pleasure. So there's the four, right? You start with pleasure, you can get more pleasure, or sometimes you get pain, depending on what you're cultivating. And you start with pain and you get more pain. And that's, so he's sort of laying out the options. So here, this is basically what he's saying. Pleasant to start, painful in the end. Painful to start, painful in the end. Painful to start, pleasant in the end. Pleasant to start, pleasant in the end. These are the four possibilities of how we undertake things, right? Pleasant to start, painful in the end. This is, my notes say here. This is a pretty good description of normal life, right? We indulge in something pleasant, but in doing so, we harm our body and have to deal with the harm later in life. There's that famous saying here, a moment on the lips and a lifetime on the hips. This is like in the cultural language, right? But it's true. And this is also true, as much, in fact, probably more true on the mental level as opposed to on the physical level, where we consume things mentally all the time. And we're making choices all the time on what we choose to consume. And sometimes they're pleasant and sometimes they're not. So this, think of this. This is a fairly common experience I've had, putting this into terms of practice. I'm sitting, practicing, doing my meditation practice, right? I'm sitting there. And this really pleasant fantasy, well, what's going to happen in the future, sort of arises in the mind. And it's attractive, it's really pleasant. And you sort of sink into it. But at some point, you sort of wake up and go, oh, but I can't have that right now. The thing about desires, we want to have it right now. I want to have this pleasant thing right now. And it's either we wake up and go, I can't have it right now, or I'll never have that anyway. I mean, it's like, and there's pleasant in the beginning, unpleasant in the end. And it says we fall into that habit, the mind habit, going towards the pleasant and cultivating it. Because, a little thought arises, and what do? We sort of expand it, and now it becomes this glorious story. We've cultivated that little bit of thought into some big, giant fantasy. And it might take us, 5 years to figure out it's just a fantasy. It might take us 5 minutes. Still a fantasy. And it always is going to end with unpleasant in the end. And this is just how our minds operate. I want to read something from Joseph Goldstein here. This is from his book, Mindfulness. And he's basically what we're talking about here is wholesome effort. Wholesome effort is all about making wholesome choices about what we're choosing to do and not do. And this is Joseph saying, this aspect of right effort points to a fundamental understanding of how our mind works. In the suttas, the most pragmatic description of nibbana is the mind that is free from the root defilements of greed, hatred, and delusion. We've all experienced many wholesome mind moments when these defilements are not present, and yet also have had unwholesome factors frequently reemerge as conditions change. This is the functioning of what are called latent defilements, mind states that are not present in the moment, but that have the potential to arise whenever the conditions for them to reappear are present. So there we are sitting mindfully, there's no defilement, there's nothing going on, and then Who knows why? Causes and conditions means who knows. There it is. Like we can't figure out why that world was, but there it is. It is just this understanding that can inspire a feeling of spiritual urgency. When we're leading basically good and wholesome lives, it's easy to become complacent about our present circumstances. But even under these favorable conditions, we still have many moments when greed, hatred, or delusion arises. We see something beautiful and we want it. Our minds are pulled toward it. Perhaps we see somebody doing something we don't like, and the mind is suddenly filled with judgment and aversion. Or we may be tired, and the mind simply dulls out in delusion. So the first of the four great endeavors is recognizing the enduring power of these defilements, understanding what gives rise to them, and preventing them from arising and taking hold. This is a very good description of the first of the four great efforts. Doing what you can to make sure that unwholesome mind states don't arise. And that's why mindfulness is so important, because mindfulness is there. If we're being mindful and we see something arising and we know, oh, I know where that goes, if I follow down that chain, then we can go, nah, I'm not going to do that. That's a choice we make all the time. We're always making choices about where the mind goes. Is it going to follow that thread or follow that thread? And so we're making that choice consciously to follow the wholesome thread. I can either go out and get drunk, or I can go for a walk in the forest. I mean, that's an extreme example, but that's the kind of decisions people make all the time. Which of these two makes more sense? Which one is more wholesome? Which leads to less suffering? And we learn what our habitual patterns are, how we often get pulled into something just because it's habit. Well, I've always done that. I go out Friday night with the boys. It's just part of what I do. So seeing these things is, in a sense, acting on and acting, choosing what to act on is the first form of right effort. Doing what we can to prevent the arising of unwholesome mind states. And we all know things in our past or in our habitual way of dealing with things where we just get lost over and over again. We fall into these habitual patterns, and there we are. And often the thing about these habitual patterns is they're often pleasant at the beginning. We don't notice the underlying tension, the underlying whatever, and we just follow along this path yet again, and sure enough, here we are, painful in the end, again. So it's, and this is like wisdom has to be applied. So that's the first of these, right? The second of these, painful to start, painful in the end. This is also a good description of our practice sometimes. We have habits that we know cause us and others suffering. We know this. It's very clear to us. We know it. But we continue with them anyway. And because that's how we've always done things. And I read someplace that this is a really good description of addiction. This is what addiction means. We're addicted to doing things that cause harm to ourselves and others. Whether it's overeating or, all the ways we can abuse ourselves with substances of various sorts, or it could be, just having this one person who we always get snarly with. Something about this person, and who knows what it is, but just I see them and the snarl arises. And we fall into that unpleasant thing that happens with us, this person. So it's a good description of addiction. I think it's also, here's another great quote I like. Insanity is repeating the same action over and over again, expecting a different result. So what we do, we keep doing it, oh, because this time it'll work out. This time it'll be okay. It's so easy to fall into that mind pattern because it's easier to fall into that mind pattern than to, go, no, I don't need to do that. So seeing these things as they arise, and there we are maybe in the midst, but then we see the mindfulness arises enough that we go, oh, it's that one again. And this is the second form of right effort. When an unwholesome mind state has arisen, do what you can to end it. Oh, here I am caught in this whole nonsense thing. I have to stop and walk away from it. I have to let it go. I don't need to do this again. Because every time I do this, I end up in that painful place where I'm full of regret or I'm full of, residual anger and whatever else you get left with depends on the situation. Joseph, of course, has something to say about this too. He's talking about the hindrances. At times, though, the hindrances may be tenacious, and we need additional strategies for abandoning them. So this is here, we're caught in this unwholesome mind state. We're caught in this unwholesome action, or continuous form of action, or set of actions, or whatever. What can we do? And then we wake up, we're mindful enough, but it's, how do we break out of that? How do we stop? In one sutta, the Buddha describes five techniques for dispelling distracting thoughts and unwholesome mind states. The first is using its opposite as an antidote. For example, if ill will has arisen, we can refocus the mind on metta. Or if restlessness is present, calming the mind through calming the breath can be helpful. If envy or jealousy is strong, we can turn the mind to the feeling of mudita, sympathetic joy. All of these remedies come from understanding that we have an inner remote control with an ability to change channels. Here I am caught in that rant again about that person. Can I, instead of just continuing my thoughts of ill will about this person, go, can I have thoughts of loving kindness about this person instead? Can I change the channel? That's all that is. It's just, it's a conscious choice to keep making. If I want to, I can change the channel. The second means, and then Joseph goes on, the second means for removing wholesome states already arisen is through the factors of hiri and ottapa, often translated respectively as self-respect and respect for the wise. These wholesome factors of mind bring a heightened sense of conscience and responsibility. Reflecting on how the wise might view an unwholesome mind state or activity is often a powerful ally in this endeavor to abandon what is unwholesome for this reason. These factors are called the guardians of the world. Care is also needed here so that this review of our actions is done from a place of wise understanding and not simply feeding into patterns of self-judgment or guilt. It's the balance. Used wisely, hiri and ottapa can awaken us from the power of deluded thinking. And so he's saying here, we have to, we can actually consciously go, oh, I see that how I'm acting right now, how I'm speaking right now, how I'm thinking right now, is I'm showing lack of respect for myself. I'm showing lack of ability to sort of keep it together. I'm choosing to do that. And that sort of, just that sense of, oh, other people. And it's not like you're guilting yourself or judging yourself. It's just like, here I am again, acting in a way that's unwholesome. I need to have more respect for myself and not do this. It's like waking up to that. That's why they call these things self-respect and respect for the wise. So respect for the wise implies, you know, what my teachers would think, what other people who are deep into this practice would think of me thinking or acting or speaking in this way. And sometimes just that thought is like, oh. In this sutta that he's referring to, this is described as, imagine what it would be like if you had a dead snake wrapped around your neck. You know, like that, it's like, ugh, sort of, essentially. You know, and sometimes we have to go, ugh, to what's going on in our mind. It's like, oh my God, ugh. And that, how you would feel walking around with a dead snake around your neck, that's the feeling you want to sort of wake up to. It's like, oh, should have a little more respect for myself than to walk around wearing a dead snake. Anyhow, we go on. So the third of these, painful to start, pleasant in the end. This is also a good description of what practice is sometimes like. You know, practice is sometimes difficult as we learn to actually pay attention to what is arising. Instead of just reacting with aversion to anything that is unpleasant, we often end up experiencing painful memories of the past or worries about the future. These thoughts are there, they are going to arise, but we're being mindful of them. They're painful, they're unpleasant, but because we can be mindful of them, then we gradually see them for what they are. And now they just become the object of our mindfulness. There's nothing, they lose their power because we're now just being very clearly mindful. Oh, this unpleasant thing has arisen in my mind, or this unpleasant feeling has arisen in my body. And that's okay. This is the hard part of the practice, right? It's like to be able to see these things arise and not judge ourselves or push them away or pretend they're not there. Oh yeah, I'm also capable of having that in my mind. But I can be aware of it, mindful of it, not struggle with it, and just be like, oh, that's okay. It's really unpleasant, but that's okay. It's just what's there. Because we know that that mind state that's arisen, that we're struggling with, that's unpleasant, is going to go away because it's just like every other mind state, things arise, they're there for a while, and then they're gone. It's going to go away. We know that really clearly. And so we can sort of let those things be. And part of what this practice is about is learning be okay with those things arising. To not feel like I shouldn't have lusty thoughts. I shouldn't ever have angry thoughts. Which is just this, I have to be perfect. Perfection, you know, it's just a recipe for more suffering. Trying to be perfect just make you suffer more. Don't go there. It's not like we need to be perfect. It's not like our mind stream has to be pure all the time. Stuff is going to be there. Like, that's the nature of the mind stream. Stuff is there. And it's like, pfft, not so wonderful, not so pleasant, difficult. And part of this is also learning to have a little bit of a sense of humor. Like, oh, that one. And be able to laugh at ourselves a little bit. You know, because we think when we're really mindful of it, they arise and we're being really mindful. And we've had that experience 3 or 4 times and they got, finally I've got rid of that one. Believe me, you'll never be rid of that one. It'll keep coming, but you'll become less and less reactive to it. Less and less you'll need to do something about it. That's what's there. And that's okay. It's a different way of reacting to them. So they're not painful in the end, they're pleasant. Because being mindful, being in a state of pure mindfulness, is extremely pleasant. Even if you're being mindful about something that's unpleasant, the mindfulness itself is a pleasant, wholesome mind state. And you'll experience that pleasantness. Finally, door number 4. Pleasant to start, pleasant at the end. Also a good description of what happens in practice sometimes. There are times in this practice where there's incredibly sweet, you're in this calm, still, focused state. And it might be just, you know, one of your daily sits, you sit down and, you know, you finish your 45 minutes or half an hour or whatever, and you go, wow, that was pleasant. Because it is sometimes. This is the natural occurrence. And we have to acknowledge them as well. When these wholesome, pure, happy mind states arise, it's like we have to note them and say, oh, look, happiness has arisen. Calm has arisen. Pure, clean mindfulness has arisen. My mind's really concentrated right now. Joy has arisen. We have to honestly and openly acknowledge them. And then, that's part of the fourth form of right effort. You know, when a wholesome mindset has arisen, we should do what we can to preserve that wholesomeness. Not by clinging to it, but just by acknowledging it and sort of going, it's more likely it's going to hang around. Like we're not getting distracted from this wholesomeness. We're just like experiencing the joy, the happiness, the calm, the stillness, whatever it is. And tuning into it and really being, let our mind rest on that. Let that be what we're mindful of. Because that mindfulness will preserve it to a certain extent. But of course it's going to go away. Like everything. I mean, it's like, you know, just things arise and then they go away. That's just the nature of everything. It's also pointing to the fact that it's really important that we enjoy our practice. Which is, seems like an obvious thing to say. But this practice, if you're not careful, you can turn this practice into this really spiritual way to just beat yourself up over and over and over again. To see all these horrible things arising in the mind and you're full, oh, I'm full of anger, I'm full of this, I'm full of that, I'm such a bad person, I'm so lustful, blah, blah, blah. And you turn it into like, it's like flagellation method. That's purely mental, but it's still that's what it is. And this practice brings joy. And we have to enjoy our practice. Even when we're struggling, you know. I had a teacher once who said something to me. He said, you know, I was talking about how I was really struggling in my practice at the time. You know, having these, you know, sitting periods that were just like train wrecks, one after another. And he said to me, but you went and you sat, huh? Yeah, I did. He said, think about how wholesome that is, that you actually did it, that you hung in there with this unpleasantness, but you actually kept the discipline and kept the practice. Oh, yeah. just that all by itself brought some joy. I wasn't just beating myself up all the time. I was acknowledging that I had been diligent. Diligence is a wholesome mind state. And then we start to see that sometimes when we're struggling. Acknowledge that is important. So that's this sutta. There is, however, another really interesting sutta. And it's related, it's the same idea. It's got four things. I want to read a little bit of this. This is the Vanapata Sutta. It's called the Jungle Thickets Sutta. This is the Buddha. Bhikkhus, I shall teach you a discourse on jungle thickets. Listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, Venerable Sir. They always say yes, Venerable Sir. Here, because a bhikkhu lives in some jungle thicket. While he's living there, his unestablished mindfulness does not become established. His unconcentrated mind does not become concentrated. His undestroyed taints do not come to destruction. He does not attain the unattained supreme security from bondage, and also the requisites of life that should be obtained by one gone forth. Robes, alms food, resting place, and medicinal requisites are hard to come by. The bhikkhu should consider thus: I am living in this jungle thicket. While I am living here, all these things, I do not attain the supreme security from bondage, and also the requisites of life are hard to come by. In other words, wake up. The bhikkhu should depart from that jungle thicket at that very night or that very day. He should not continue living there. So here you are, you're a very disciplined student, and you've gone to live in this jungle thicket. And things just aren't going your way. And not only are they not going your way, but it's hard to get what you need to just sort of live, the requisites. You go to the village and they put 3 grains of rice in your bowl, that sort of thing. So, but here's these four, once again, here's these four things. Not succeeding and the requisites are poor. Time to go. Not succeeding, good requisites. In other words, you're getting fed well, you have a nice place to sleep, you've got a really nice robe. If you get sick, there's always someone to take care of you. But your practice just doesn't happen. Buddha says, go. This would be hard, right? Because you got everything that makes sort of your life easy, but your practice isn't going anywhere. Time to stay. Then there's the next one is you're succeeding. Practice is going well, but the requisites are poor. The things you need to sort of keep going in your daily life are poor. Buddha says, stay. Your practice is going great. That's what's important. And then your practice is succeeding, and you have good requisites as well. Then obviously stay. See, here's the thing. It's like there's two things, succeeding and what the requisites are like. Four combinations. Two of them say, don't stay there, go find some other place. And two of them say, stay. But one of them is you got poor requisites, you're not eating that well, your robe is kind of tatty, you have trouble getting medicine when you're sick, etc. But your practice is just going really strong. Stay. And then the sutta goes on, it goes on to say this, it says, the sutta goes on to say that the same applies wherever the bhikkhu might be practicing, in a particular village, town, city, or country, or dependent on a particular person. So it isn't just jungle thickets, because monastics practice in all these different places, and it doesn't make any difference. They're staying in this village and practicing, and the requisites are good. But your practice isn't going anywhere, get out of town. The interesting thing about this teaching, however, I think, is that how do we apply this to our practice, to our lives? We're not renunciates. We're not going to go hang out in a jungle thicket. We're not dependent on requisites. We're not dependent on other people to feed us and make sure we have a nice hut to stay in. So, what does this mean for us householders? And I think it points to the idea that we have to be conscious of how our practice is going. Not in some sort of like judgmental, oh, and my practice is horrible, but just like be mindful. Yeah, if I look over this period of time where I've been practicing diligently, or at least I think I have. Has things improved? Has my practice gone deeper? Do I see things a little more clearly, or not? And then, based on that, we have to then look at our life in the world. Is how I'm living in the world affecting my practice? Are the things I'm doing in the world that get in the way of my practice, that make me practice less, that lead me away from leading a wholesome life? So it's like, it's not like just my practice, but is my life succeeding? Is my life improving? Is my life getting better in the broad sense of more wholesomeness? In the broad sense of more calm? In the broad sense of more generosity? And if that's true, then hey, I'm going to hang out and stay with this practice and continue practicing the way I am and where I am, how I'm living the rest of my life. But if I look at the rest of my life and see, hey, this stuff is getting in the way of my practice. This is like, I may have all the requisites I need. I may have, have my 3 squares a day and a roof over my head, and maybe even, a nice car and all those sorts of things. But my practice just isn't going anywhere. It's not. I don't have enough time or energy or whatever to put into my practice. Then we have to start, have to go, oh, not succeeding, good requisites. Maybe I should look at that. Maybe I need less stuff. I need to get less stuff. I need to have less nice stuff. And that gives me more time to practice. Once again, this is, it's just like more suffering or more happiness. These are decisions we make all the time in our householder life. What we need, what we don't need. What else I need, I don't need. Oh, I don't need that. I can let that go. I don't have to have as many of those. I always think of when I used to work as a carpenter and a handyman, and I'd meet these guys. They would have like 3 of the same saw because one was a little better than the other, or he saw this other one and someone told him it was so great. And then he would complain that he has to work so hard all the time to, keep his head above water. I'd go, excuse me, do you really need those 3 saws? And it'd be like, I would say that very gently, and it'd be like, well, of course, I mean, those are my saws, And that's an example of, he's got lots of great requisites, but his life wasn't succeeding because he was too much into acquiring cool things. I have to be, I go to McGuckin's Hardware and I have to be really careful walking through the tool section. I always speed right through there because even now, I go, ooh, look at that. Cool, whatever it is, I don't have one of those, or I used to have one that broke, or whatever. It's like, man, I don't need that tool anymore. Honestly, I haven't had any need for a tool like that for a year, but it looks really cool. And that's, your mind still goes there. I want more requisite space. And we don't, we have to learn to sort of go, nah, don't need that. Don't need that at all. And so I think both of these suttas, pointed to two very important things. So, summing up, whatever. We have to sometimes step back and look at our life and our practice sometimes. We get so much into the rhythm of living our lives the way we live our lives and practicing the way we practice, that we don't step back and go, is this going someplace? Can I do more practice? Am I doing too much practice and making myself crazy? Which is also a possibility. You can overdo it, you can over effort and turn into this grim person. But we need to, that means we have to sort of like step back, go, let's look at the big picture here. We're often so involved in the day-to-day that we don't stop and look at the big picture. Both of these suttas are pointing to the idea that we need to stop and look at the big picture sometimes. And the other thing is how we decide what to do in our life should be directly determined by what effect it will have on our practice. In other words, our practice becomes the most important thing. And everything else, we look at it and go, how's that going to affect my practice? Might be very attractive, might seem wonderful. How's it going to affect my practice? In the broadest sense. And be careful with that thought, because it's also a way to avoid things. Oh, I can't do that because I won't, that'll, I shouldn't do that because I'm not going to have time to do this much practice. Oh, but maybe that, whatever that is, volunteering someplace, though it isn't practice in the official sense of the word, could be a big part of your practice, actually. And being of service to others is a really wholesome practice. It creates, you learn a lot of gratitude. So I've noticed in all my times where I do volunteer stuff, which I still do some of. It's like you see how difficult other people's lives are, and you go, wow, compared to everybody else, my life is pretty great. Things are going pretty good here. And it creates gratitude, and that creates joy. And so that's as much practice as sitting and meditating. And it's like taking the teachings of the Buddha and applying them very directly to how we live our lives. And in the end, that's what we have to do. We're householders. We're not monastics. We're not just going to meditate all day long every day. We live in the world. So how can we take the teachings of the Buddha and apply them to how we live in the world? In ways that are wholesome and useful. That's really an important thing to choose to do. Piece of poetry to end, of course. This is from Dana Fault's book, Going In. And it's actually one of those poems she has in this book where there's no actual title. So the title is just the first line of the poem, which is, "And a voice spoke in the twilight." And a voice spoke in the twilight. "For I will carry you across the wide river of life and see you safely to the other side. Simile of the raft in poetic form. Be unafraid and joyous. On this shared journey, you will see miracles. You will know sadness. The heart of your heart will be glad. And at times you will suffer. But there won't be a single moment when you'll stray from the path. If you could only believe that right now, this moment is part of the journey, perhaps you'd see the futility of worry or despair. I will carry you no matter if you find the way easy and safe or rife with danger and impossibility. I will keep you in the presence of God and in the light of truth. This is my covenant with you. I speak soul to soul, and I only say what is true. With that, the night went back to stillness. She's describing a moment of deep insight into the truth. It's like, yeah, this life will always work. You just have to trust it and not have to figure it out and not have to have it be a certain way. That it can be, as she said, it can be, you will see miracles and at times will suffer. And if we only could believe that, if we could only believe and trust that going forward everything will be fine if we just stick with it, really sincerely believe it. Not in some blind, dogmatic way, but by practicing and seeing how it changes our life and affects our life, then things will be fine. Just take that in. So that's what I have to share this evening.